something a little more clean cut. But you do, you learn things and you get inspirations, especially when you interact with a culture that's so different. Things pop out at you that are probably very normal to them. And even after having been there for quite a while, so little things, well, it's been almost 2 years since I was there. I was like, oh yeah, this happens. People do this, that's good, or that's strange. Things like, well, actually, I actually went by myself. There's other people that went there, but I was in Boston, and I flew from there by myself. So I got there a day ahead of the other people that were coming for the conference that I was going for. So I flew over there, and it was, well, it wasn't horrible, but it wasn't good either. It's, there's not really a good version of that trip. And this trip started at 11 a.m. or 11 p.m. and ended at 3 a.m., so it was really horrible flight times, but it is what it is. So you get there kind of miserable and like in this otherworldly state. And I traveled through, went through the city then, got myself to the apartment where we live. But in Bangladesh, in all the buildings in the city, they lock them up like a jail. Like the bottom, the garage doors are steel, and then they lock them with a padlock, and there's a guard that sleeps down there. And so you literally can't get in or out of your own house in the middle of the night. So thought about it, Ray, like these houses don't burn well. But if they do, you would hope the guy at the bottom wakes up in time to let everyone out, because otherwise it's either that or jump out the windows. So I got there, and of course it's locked up tight. And the guard, I know him, he's an old guy, he's a really nice guy, but he's deaf as a post, which is a problem when you need him to wake up. So thankfully, he, there's like a little room that, like the front of the house is here, and the little room that sticks out, and there's a window, and he sleeps right there. I looked in, ah, there's someone in there. So I knocked, you know, like an American on the door first, at least give him a chance to wake up nicely. It's all quiet. So I knocked, like more like a Bangladeshi on the door. He still didn't wake up. So I turned and I knocked on the window. It's like this far from his head where he's, I could see his body in there sleeping. Pounded on the window. He couldn't wake up. So I started pounding and yelling, which is, you know, horrible etiquette in the middle of the night. But that's just what you do. He's the guard. That's his job. He needs to get up and open the door. So I pounded on the door and called him Mama, which is uncle. That's how you wake up on guards. Wake up, Mama. And then, there was like movements. And he looked at me with one eye. It was like this vague recognition. He said, is it just you? I said, yeah, it's just me. So he came stumbling out around the corner, unlocked like two or three padlocks and chains, and it's a complicated way to lock garage doors in Bangladesh. And he opened it up, and he was standing there. Well, it was 4:30 in the morning. You know what he looked like. That part's the same. And I said, I'm sorry, I just wake you up. I said, I just got here from America. You know, 2 years, he recognized me 2 years later. And he opened the door, and I stepped inside. And he rubbed his face, and he looked at the chair that's always there and said, well, sit down. I said, no, I haven't slept in almost 2 days. Can I go get some sleep? Why don't you go back to bed, and I'll go to bed, and I'll come talk to you in the morning. Yeah, let's do that. And he would close the door, and I think he was kind of thankful that I didn't take up his offer in hospitality. But it was impressive to me, again, that 4:30 in the morning, I've had people wake me up at 4:30 in the morning. It's usually like, sleep there, see you later. And he's like, oh, sit down, we'll talk. That's hospitality, I believe. So I was there in the city for one day, killed a day, and then the other people showed up, and we got on a train and went to where we're going to have this conference. It's up in Nazipur, if you remember those names. That's where Brian used to be. And this is up northern part of the country, more northern. And this is where the first believers were, the first converts, I don't even know how many years ago, with one man, two people, three people. And now it's, I don't know how many. I think Donald told me 260-some people are baptized there now. Not in one congregation, just like multiple of them. And so this was like a district-wide meetings, essentially. This was the first time this had happened, so everyone came together. They rented out, it was like a Catholic mission school is what it was, and they had this room there, which was maybe the size of half of our auditorium here to the back wall, roughly that big, maybe a little longer, a little narrower, roughly something like that. And they said, there's gonna be 300 people here. And there was, actually. I never counted that many inside the room because it was kind of a constant coming and going, and some of it was people who were kind of doing work. But they know that because they had these box lunches and they served over 300 of them. So 300 people actually showed up for this thing. So they had, it was 2 days, but there's a day in between. They did it Friday and Sunday. There's a rest day in between. And because some of these people traveled an hour to get there to this thing. So they came in, it's going to start at 9 o'clock, which is like, kind of a, you know, ha-ha, start at 9 o'clock. So we came at 9 o'clock. I don't know why, because I don't know why we're going at 9 o'clock. I'm not going to start at 9, but we did. We went at 9 o'clock, and a couple people were there. They started coming. After a while, there's enough people there that it was worth serving the snack. So start sitting. You sit on the floor. It's a tile floor. Take your shoes off out on the porch and sit down on the floor cross-legged. Everyone got a banana and a chunk of bread to start off the meetings. And finally, we had enough people. All right, time to start. It was like an hour late. was right on schedule, time to start. So get this thing started. So we had one of the deacons from one of the churches there had a devotions, and then time for us to start. And then, you know, we're honestly kind of soft. Like when we have a meeting like that over there, we started out with two sermons back to back after the devotions, and then lunch, and then two more, all while sitting on the floor cross-legged. I was, as the interpreter, I was one of the important people. I got to sit in front on a chair like this. So it was a little bit high. My feet hit the floor, but I don't know who builds their furniture. The podiums there were so tall that, do you know Nolan Bechtel? He was one of the preachers there. He's 6'3" and a half, I think. It felt a little on the high side for him, this podium. So like for us, it was like up here. A Bangladeshi kind of had to peek around. I don't know who builds these things. These two podiums up front, like this high, the shorter one the interpreter got because we figured he should probably be more important for them to hear him than the other guy. And so we sat up there in the front, and these people started preaching. We had Donald there to preach, Tim was there, and Nolan Bechtel, as well as actually Joel Troyer. He's from out in Arizona. They're the house parents in DACA right now. So the couple people there that are studying language came along, and he also had one of the sessions as well. So they started preaching. And Elijah and I were the translators, interpreters. And so we had figured out ahead of time who's going to do what, which was nice because then they gave us their notes and said, here's what I'm going to be talking about. And we could look at it and like, actually, I don't know much about this in Bangla. I'm going to have to look up words. So we could do that on ahead of time. So they started preaching. Two podiums. It's a little weird if you've ever been in a service that's bilingual. One guy over here talking. Everyone kind of waits for him to get done. And then they look at you, what did he say? And then you're supposed to say what he said. And so you have to go through everything twice. So it's a really awkward way of doing it, but it's kind of just the way you have to do it in that case. So we did, before we started, we drug out a blackboard and wrote salt training or something like that, the Salt Cam Salt Project, and we handed out everyone's salt manuals just in case it has happened already that someone will come poking around saying, what's going on here? What for meeting is this? And in fact, the police did actually show up. And so just in case we have to, you could switch to assault meeting just like that and say, everyone turn to page 116, lesson 7, and there's, we're having an assault meeting. But the police did show up, but I forget who was preaching. I know that Elijah's interpreting because I was sitting down, and someone said, hey, we might have to switch here. We'll let you know. There's police outside. But they went out and talked to the police, and they just wanted to make sure that the Americans weren't getting kidnapped or anything, and it was okay. We didn't have to change the meeting. So we had just church instead. And we had two sermons back to back. Elijah did one, then I did one. Then we had lunch, same thing again. Which interpreting is strange. It's really fun, except it's like a constant mind puzzle almost. The bad thing about it is you can get to the end of a sermon honestly not really be quite sure what it was about. Like you know what was things they said, but you're not quite sure what the main point of the sermon was because you're not actually paying that close attention to what they say. I don't know how to describe it. It's maybe think about if every time I said a sentence, you have to say the sentence back, but tell me what the subject and verb are in the sentence. It just wrecks the flow of the talk as you're going through. So you know what's kind of what they said, but you have this puzzle going on the whole time. And so one of the things we said, well, Elijah is a little better than me. He's done a little more Bangla training. He's been there more recently. So it's more for my benefit than his, but he used it too. Is whoever was not interpreting would sit like right there, like you could touch the person, that's how close the chairs were. And so we would just help each other, sometimes murmur under our breath words that we knew weren't going to work out for the other guy. And sometimes I would get some, Elijah, what's this word? I said, yes, that's what I mean, and could say that. I remember at least once as Elijah was going, I know he said a funny word, and as Elijah was going, I could hear the sentence coming backwards as he was stalling to get to that word, not trying not to get to that word, and when he got to it, I said it, and then he said it and kept going. So it was nice to be able to do that, sit that close, that we could bail each other out. And at least once I looked at him and he said, I don't know. I said, I don't either. Well, let's say it this way, and we try it again. So it's a challenge, but it is kind of fun too. That was for one day. The second day, we changed it up a little bit. Well, we had an off day, came back. That time we said, you know what, let's make lunch later because there were some people who had to leave first thing in the afternoon. And also, in Bangladesh, normally lunch isn't till more like 2 o'clock. So having a 12 o'clock lunch is kind of weird anyway to them. So we had three sermons in a row, boom, 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 like that, while they sat on concrete and I sat on a chair like this. We did break it up a little bit because there was a bunch of children here kind of like this, and I said, Donald, can we do like a children's meeting? Because I remember sitting in all-day meetings when I was little, and it gets super boring after a while, and I can't imagine if I had to be just squeezed into rows on concrete too. I said, sure. So what we did is between the first two, the way it shook out, I don't remember why, but Elijah ended up doing two sermons back to back, interpreting. So in between sermons one and two, we did, had like a children's meeting. I told them a story from Reynold and I when we were growing up about chasing squirrels and stuff. And squirrel stories are funny in Bangla too, if they have found that out. So we did that to break that up. Then I interpreted sermon number three, and then we had lunch. And then after that, we had like more like a, it was a breakout session, kind of. It was a split session with the men and women. And that was more like just question, answer, anything you want to talk. What are the things you wish we would talk about that weren't covered? So we had seven different sermons plus this. And just things like, what is it to build up the church? How do you, what are ways that, what do godly families look like? How do you train children? How do you spank them or not spank them? Things like this. So it was some very practical teaching, which seemed to be very well received. It was things, some of it was new things, some of it was just more clarifying of things that they knew and were thinking of, and they liked to have this extra teaching. You run into funny things like when you're trying to talk the other language. Nasty things like one of the sermons I had to interpret was on child training, all right? So words that get used a lot are parents and children, but those words don't really exist in Bangla. They say mother and father and children, boys and girls. So to me, I felt like I was dragging out everything. So when parents teach their children, when fathers and mothers teach their boys and girls, and it just seems really wordy, but it's just the best way to do it. You make mistakes. The classic one, I don't think I even told him, but I heard Elijah make it. I was listening for it because I've made this mistake, and that's the difference between nimontron and neontron is the difference between an invitation and controlling. So you're talking about controlling yourself. You can invite yourself if you're not careful. And the mistake I made that I was suspicious of but couldn't remember in the heat of the moment, so I checked later, and yes, I had said it backwards, was I was talking about hamla, meaning a case like in court, which is actually mamla, and so I was talking about attacking or torturing someone instead of having a case. So hopefully the Holy Spirit fixed up some of that stuff, and that's what you get when you have interpreters that have 9 months of training. But I think it was a blessing to them. They said so. Aman specifically was thanking us, me. He said, it's so nice that he does a lot of the interpreting a lot of times. And he said the same thing. He said, so much of the time when he interprets, he can't even remember what it was about until the end of the day. Because, number one, it's mentally very draining. Number two, you're not actually paying that much attention to the content as much as you're paying attention to the words and the grammar so that you can rebuild this sentence into the other language. And so he says, I missed so much of it. Now I can just sit down. He has the benefit of understanding both languages, so he got to hear two attempts at what was trying to be said. And so he said, it's so nice to be able to do that. And just all of them as the leaders who end up having to do some of this stuff, they could just sit down and listen and not have to worry about that. It's nice to have that. And even the preaching, it wasn't them preaching. They could listen to someone else preach. And so it said that was nice for them not to have to deal with that problem. It's a blessing to me. It's fascinating to go into another, it doesn't even seem like church. You're sitting on a floor somewhere in this little tiny building, and the people are talking another language, and the format of the service is different. But they're saying the same things, and they're being excited about a lot of the same things. And it's like, hey, it's true that the church is global. Here it is. They're excited about Jesus too, and we're trying to follow God. And so it's enjoyable to me. It's enjoyable to be able to do something like that, and it seems like you're helping a tiny little bit somewhere in the church. And I think one of the things that was a blessing to me was at the end of this whole meeting, after these eight sermons and lots of sitting on the floor, one of the girls said she actually got a blister on her ankle bone from sitting on it on concrete for 2 days straight. I was like, I got a chair. So yeah, we saw your chairs. We're not that jealous. But at the end of all this, they said, all right, we're good. Time to finish the meeting up. And they had one of the local men there. God, his name is Hasib, and it was his job to close the meeting. He just spoke for a few minutes, but he said he was talking to them, and he was talking in Bangla. He wasn't talking to us, but he couldn't have talked to us anyway because it wouldn't have made sense to us. It was just interesting to listen to. I could listen to him, and he was talking to them. He said, this meeting was so much, was so helpful. It was such a blessing. He said, do you remember before we knew about Jesus when we were still Muslims? He said, do you remember how we used to be so scared? We tried to follow God, but we didn't know. We weren't sure, and we did not know what would happen after we died. We were trying to follow God so we would hopefully go to heaven, but we didn't know. Do you remember that? And they said, yeah, we remember that. We said, well, it's not like that anymore, is it? We're not scared anymore. Because now, because of the grace of Jesus in our lives, we know that we're saved. We know we're the children of God. Now we know we're going to heaven. They said, yes, that's right. That's the way it is now. And all of a sudden, I was the outsider because I didn't remember what that was like. That had never been that way. But it was fascinating to listen to them talk about that and see them being able to connect. And that was something that didn't make sense to me. So that was a blessing to me, even though it was as a third party. So it was good. From there, I traveled down to Bajor, where I used to live, and met Dad and Jen there, and we had more meetings there, but I'll let him talk about that. Then I was just saying whatever he said. Well, actually, no, I did have to preach the one night, which is honestly a lot easier than interpreting, because you know what the guy's going to say, because you're the guy. And so that is actually, it's actually easier to preach than to interpret. It seems like it maybe is a little smoother, but it was hard work, but it was good work. It was interesting, and it was a blessing, at least to me, and I think to them too. Hopefully it was to them as well.
I too greet you in Jesus' name, and am quite happy to be here in this place, not just here at church, but back in America with my family, with the land that I'm used to, and somehow it doesn't seem quite as rigorous either. Before I get started, I wanted you to turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 14. Stephen talked about this whole concept of bringing a report back. And I was looking this morning. I was fairly certain that in the book of Acts, this happened a number of times. But I just want to look at Acts 14, where it happened, where Paul and his missionary group came back to the church of Jerusalem and gave a report. And I just was intrigued with the words that Paul uses, or how Luke records their little time of testimony went. Look at Acts 14, verse 20. I'll start at verse 24. This is basically they're coming home. And after they had passed throughout Pisidia, they came to Pamphylia, and when they had preached the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia, and thence sailed to Antioch, from whence they had been recommended to the grace of God for the work which they had fulfilled. And when they were come and had gathered the church together, they rehearsed all that God had done with them, and how he had opened the door of the faith unto the Gentiles, and there they abode a long time with the disciples. So you have these men that were sent. It actually says there in verse 25 that they were sent from there, recommended to the grace of God for work, and they had fulfilled it, and they came home, and they gave their testimony. And what I like about this little line here, it says that they told of the work that God had done with them. Now, sometimes we talk about serving the Lord. We talk about, just doing things in Christ. But it says that they bore testimony of what God had done with them, which simply means to me that they were his vessels and they were his tools. And just like you would nail a nail with a hammer, and God had worked with them, you have this picture of the Almighty taking a man and putting him to a work and bringing him through that work, and they come back and they say, God used us this way. And I think that's important, because when it comes to coming home and telling about what you have gone through or what your experience has been, there really is a ditch on both sides of the road. One is that we can be almost so temporal that all it is just a story about a trip. And the other one is that we can be so spiritual, as it were, about it, that all of a sudden we give the impression that in some fantastic way, God was doing something in us and with us that he doesn't do here in America. And that's not true either. But really, a trip like this is nothing more. Maybe nothing more isn't the right way to say it. A trip like this is just simply another day of walking with God. And it is true that because we got on an airplane and we put ourselves through they seem rigorous to me. I've been there multiple times now, but the journey is still a hunkering down. From the COVID test to the getting over the jet lag when you get home, there's just a part of it that I'm not going to try and kid anybody about how fun it is, because the fun moments are sparse, and there's at least some of the time where you know that you're just getting out of bed, no matter how you feel, and you're going to do the next thing because it's time to do it. And It doesn't mean that you won't find blessings in it. It doesn't mean that you won't come home and say, I'm glad I did that. You might also come home and say, I don't know if I ever want to do that again, but that's just the reality of what it is. Well, we did make a trip. Jen and I left on Friday, October 22nd, which had been 2 weeks ago from this past Friday. And we traveled, got the doc on about Sunday dinner at the apartment, but because of this seminar, everybody was gone, so we had the place to ourselves. But there's a young man by the name of Shobush who works for the NGO, and he is always available. He knows English fairly decent, and I have his number, and it is just so nice to be able, even while you're still in America, to pick up your phone and call Shobush and say, I'm coming in on this flight into the Dhaka airport. Will you help me get to the apartment? I think by now I could get there with signs and wonders, but why bother when you can get a friend to help you? And so when we came out of customs immigrations and changed our money into Dhaka, why, it was so nice to see Shobush, and he got us a CNG, that's a little three-wheel cart with a cage around it, and we piled into there, and we went buzzing off through the city, got to the apartment about dinner time on Sunday. And then later that day, Seth Reif, who was coming over to join the language class, showed up and was there. We left Monday morning and got on a bus for the town is Digraj, and that's just simply the village right on the other side of the river from Bajua. Bajua, as you may remember, is an island. It is, as the rivers come down through Bangladesh, somewhere up north of Khulna, they split and come back together. And at the top end of this island, they split, and water goes around on each side of it and joins again down at the Sundarbans, where the tigers and the monkeys run around. But that's about 30 miles south of where we were. But to get to this village, you take the bus to this Digraj, and then you just go down to the shore, and there's little, some people call them Jesus boats, or the little, well, not little, they're about 35 feet long and about 6-7 feet wide, and they have little Wisconsin engines on them, and they fire them up, and you go putt, putt, putt across the river day or night, and that's how you get to Bajwa. And then you, from there, you walk up to your house. We now stay at a place called The Company. The teams, when they were there, stayed at a building called CSS, which is a derelict old rundown place, and this company works a lot better because they have a guest house with two rooms in it. And it's nice. It's inside a walled, it's about 30 acres. There's a little pond in there. And it's nice because it gives you a place to just get away when it's time or when you would like to. And you kind of have it to yourself. You can go up on the rooftop and be all alone, and it's quiet and cool in the morning. It was still, the summer is coming to an end, but most days it hit 90 degrees and it would go down into the mid upper 70s at night, and usually it was between 60% and 85% humidity, so you're wet most of the time. And but walk everywhere you go, that's how you do on this island. They have the little electric carts, but motorcycles, if you really want to go far. But for our purposes, we walk everywhere we go. It was, according to my phone counter, I walked anywhere from 6 to 8 miles every day. That's how you do. You get blisters on your feet because our soft patties are not ready for that kind of thing. But that's what we did, and that's how we got around. I did find it interesting, one day Brendel and I went over to the CSS building where the team was, and you may or may not remember, but the last time there was a team over there was when COVID was coming in, and because of the way government mandates were starting to work, why all of a sudden international travel was closed on about 12 hours notice, and the teams all dropped everything. And I don't know if this is what it's gonna look like when the Lord comes back, but we went over to that building and there's still wash hanging on the line there that the team left. It's a year and a half later. And there's kettles sitting around that were never washed, and they left and nobody else cleaned up after them. So there it is. And it's kind of an eerie testimony. You go in there and say, what in the world? But you know, it's just what happens when it's time to go and you gotta be in Dhaka in about 10 or 11 hours, why, you go. And stuff got left behind that you soon learned you could do without. But there's always interesting things I saw an ad, boys, you'll like this. Inside the company, there's this wall, Nurses Pond, and it's a lot of brush around just off the porch. I mean, from here to that wall, it's just brush. One morning, I'm sitting there. It's early in the morning. I couldn't sleep, but it's getting light. And I'm sitting there on a chair, and I'm trying to read my Bible, and all of a sudden, I see an animal. And it's an animal you don't have around here. We have some like it, but it was about that long, with a tail about that long, and it was dark brown, and it just runs all the time. Sort of reminds you of a mink. You know what it was? It was a mongoose. But it was a baby mongoose, and there was two others. There was a little nest in the bushes, and they kept coming out and running around. And one day, Dabu, the man who was in charge of this property, asked me if there was anything I needed. I said, yes, I would like you to catch one of those for me. I'd like to take it along home. He laughed. He said, you can't catch them, because they run really fast. But they would come out every morning. I tried. It was too groggy. I should have taken pictures. But anyway, this trip was interesting because I got to see some mongooses running around. And the other thing I saw that you boys might like that was interesting is that usually the fishing all gets done with nets. But when we went to market day, I found that they have some fishing rods for sale in there. And there's people starting to use fishing rods at Bajua. But I saw one man. He was fishing in the river that comes up through the village. It's one of those that the tide affects. And he was sitting there, and I went over, and he had a stick of bamboo about 8 foot long, and he had a string. And you know what he had on for bait? A worm. They use the same thing to catch fish over in Bangladesh as they do here in the Juniata River. And I thought that was interesting. The village, a lot of things the same. You know, what's interesting to me about this island is this is the place in Bangladesh where there was a Catholic mission started 120, 110 years ago. And so there is a Christian name there. There's churches there. You walk back through that one road, and I think on the way to our church services, I counted three different church buildings. Two of them are empty and unused. There they are. But then you also, right along the road, you'll have the Hindus and the Muslims. And they're people that just, they need the Lord. And it's a little bit different mission work in that, I mean, I don't even know if they have police on this island. Well, they're pretty invisible if they do. It's pretty much, they all take care of each other and themselves. And the crimes are taken care of right there on the village. But it's full of people that need Jesus. Prayer call goes three times a day, and you know, at first it's intriguing, then it's irritating, and then you forget about it. It becomes part of the noise of the country. But the Muslim faith is there. I was a little bit taken, well, more than a little bit taken aback. When we were there in February, we went down to the one tea stall, Abu Bakar's, and they took us in the back and showed us his father was sick with cancer. And at that point, he was laying there on the bed. And this was not a Serta mattress. This was just simply a wooden box with some blankets on it. And the man is laying there, and he's dying of cancer. He has throat cancer. He cannot eat. He cannot swallow. And they thought maybe he'll die in a few days. And, you know, you just wish you could say something to him about his soul, but I don't even have the words. And so you appeal to some of the Christians there. Can you go talk to this man and offer him Jesus before he dies? And I forgot about him. Well, I was stunned the one day when we went over there and they said, well, the stall's not open because the old man died. He lived another 9 months. And they showed me a picture of him. It did not even look like a person. It was just all shriveled up. I don't know how long he must have been since he ate, but I guess he still died without Jesus. I feel kind of bad about that. I don't know what to do. I know this happens in our village too, but there he is. You walk down the street at dusk and you hear the Hindu women start to call upon their gods. They have that high, fluty whistle that they're doing as they're calling out to their gods, ring their bells and smell the incense. And it's idolatry, just like in the Bible times and just like we've read about in the books. There it is, right there in the village. But it's a poor village. But there is a little congregation there of people that have joined together. They want to follow Jesus. And that was our whole reason for going, to minister to those people. There is about, I think there's around 18 or 20 members. I'd have to get the list out and count through them again. But the church is not doing all that well. Some brothers were over in, well, let me back up. When I was there, a group of us was there in February. We spent most of our time in brothers' meetings and meetings because there was a lot of interpersonal stress. There was a man ordained there, and he did well as a minister for about the first 8-9 months. But as time went along, I'm going to call it a rut began to set in, and he became just another Christian pastor who saw being a church leader as a way to have authority, a good way to have an income, and to make a living. And in as that thing began to evolve and he began to turn into a mainstream Christian pastor like they knew so well on that island, of course a lot of stress started to come into relationships. He began to scorn people that would not give him money. At least this is how it looks. And he began to ask them for money. He began to ask us for money, to tell us that we're not supporting them very well. And if these were things that we had covered long before he was ordained, covered routinely and regularly. But in the end, things got so bad that in August, when some of the brothers were over, the stresses were terrible. And he had actually divided the church about 2 weeks before. He just simply went off to another house and started worshiping there. Didn't tell anybody, refused to talk to the people. So when the other brothers were there, they officially, we call it silencing him. They took away his pastorship, said, you can't be the minister here anymore because of these things. And so I knew that when we got back, at the minimum, the skeletons were going to be there. Well, it was more than skeletons. And it is true that out of, well, what has happened is the minister and his wife and their son, the minister's wife's sister and their grandmother, the minister's father and mother are part of the church, but there's about seven of them that since they divided and the brothers took away the minister's charge, they have not attended church at all. They just sit at home. They don't go anywhere. And so part of our work was not just encouraging the things that remain, but to try and reach into those homes and see what we could do to reconcile, redeem, restore. And that kind of thing is hard enough when you can both talk English, but when they speak a language that I don't understand at all, and you rely on people like Brendel to say, what are they saying? And it bogs down. It is something that I feel so keenly. I've been in many church stresses already in my life where we all talked English and I felt pretty helpless. But it goes to a different level of helplessness when you just can't talk and yet you need to talk. And you try to talk and you try to, the channel of hearing them out and then taking them back and getting your Bible out and saying, but here's what the Bible says. And then they read that in Bangla and take it back. And sometimes the lights come on and sometimes they don't. But you keep trying. And it's not a lost cause. There's probably still a dozen members there and there are other people attending the little church and they are trying to go on. They have no leader. And quite frankly, we don't know what to do about that because we could look for another one, but we feel like we have to really be cautious before we ordain somebody else because it's going to have to be somebody that has demonstrated rather clearly and consistently that they can live with the power that comes with leadership and still be a godly person. It's the same challenge we have, but it seems almost worse in that culture because they have a lot of experience of the other kind of leadership. But there is people there, and we got there on Monday afternoon, and we stayed till Sunday dinner, and Tuesday was market day, which everything revolves around market day. It's about 12 hours. The boats come in from the other towns, and they have this huge bazaar where things are bought and sold for the week. It's the market day. They didn't want to try and have church because there's men that have stores that they need to be at at work. They can't close their store down to go do something else. So we started on Wednesday evening, Thursday evening, Friday evening, and Saturday evening. Had church services every night, close to revivals as I knew we could get. But first night, I just preached a sermon out of the Gospels of Jesus' words in Luke 9. What is it? Come and follow me. And then we just went back and we looked at Peter, James, and John, and Andrew, and Matthew, as Jesus called them. So how did it affect these people's lives? And what was the difference it made? And what did that do with their families? And what did that do with their business? And things like that. And just talk those things out. And the second night was when Brendel had his sermon or topic. And basically, from what I could tell, he was going over how do you study the Bible? How's it laid out? 66 books, and you know, some of the things we teach each other when it comes to Bible study. And then he finished up with the whole idea that at the end of the day, it's not just reading this, but this is actually instructions for you to do. And afterwards, some of the young men came to him and said that they were glad he told them that. They said, "Do you mean now when you read the Bible, it's not just an interesting story, but there's things that it says in here that you're supposed to do?" And that's right. That's what I was trying to tell you. Okay, well, thanks for that. We'll look at it differently now. And, you know, it's all part of bringing truth to somebody and letting the little seed sprout and grow up. And where's it going to go? I don't know. But you keep praying and go on. Friday night, we were going to end up with communion. It had been almost 2 years since they had communion, and we wanted to share it with them. And so Friday night, we had a council meeting, but in the message, I basically explained what council meeting is, how you examine yourself. Gave them a list of 5 questions. Now, here's a question. What's my relationship with God? Here's how you test it. What's my relationship with Jesus? Here's how I test it. Here's the truth you put. What's my relationship with other people? Am I forgiving? Do I love? Am I a servant? Does it show up? Or do I talk bad about people? And you just get practical. And after that, we went around and gave our testimonies just like we do in America. And some of them, it was new. They had not done it yet in their lives. And what we explained, it was all in a preparation for tomorrow night. We'll have communion. And Saturday night, we had communion and feet washing. And again, there's a lot to cover in a service like that. First, some people had done it once in their lives. Some had done it numerous times because they were part of the Catholic Church at one time. And they would have gone through those rituals. But to try and teach it to be an authentic commemoration of Jesus. And you wonder how much. And then we went into feet washing. And it's intriguing to me, both in the North churches and on this island, when you have a feet washing service, it seems like that ordinance and that ceremony speaks to those people more than the communion does. They can hardly, you see, one of the things that is a whole lot more clear, I think I want to say, in the Bangladeshi culture as opposed to ours, is this whole thing of where people rank, who's on top, who's in the middle, and who's on the bottom. Now, come on, if you just strip away all your self-pretense, where do you fit here in Tyrone? Are you on the upper echelon? Are you one of the middle people, or are you one of the dirt? Most of us don't even know how to rate ourselves. We can go through some calisthenics of doing it, but those people know exactly where they wrote. And there were people that cried over the feet washing service because they were dirt Hindus. They were the scum of society. But somebody who was rated way above them stood down, kneeled down, and washed their feet. And they got it. They actually got it. And they could not believe that in this new faith, somebody would love them that was ranked way above them. But you know what? That's what feet washing, that's what we tried to tell each other all our lives, feet washing actually is. But we get kind of fuzzy on the edges because we don't understand slaves and masters all that well. It's not real common to our culture. Anyway, it was just something interesting to watch. Well, the next morning, we made the circuits through the town, said our goodbyes, and headed back for Dhaka. Get another COVID test. wait for the plane, stand in the lines, and work our way home. And the Lord kept us safe. One of the things that's so interesting to me, it's not always enjoyable, but it's interesting. I find myself, when I travel, make that trip, I find myself praying over details of life that I don't feel real motivated to pray about in this life here. I'll give you an easy one. I find myself, when I climb on the jet, to pray for a couple open seats beside me. Now, I don't think any of you are going to pray at all this week where you get to sit on the school van. It's not that important. But I find it to be a difference maker if I can have three seats beside me, that when that plane goes off, I can just lay flat out and sleep for 6 or 8 hours while it takes 12 or 13, as opposed to trying to stay upright in a seat and make the same thing happen. And it actually makes a difference. And so you pray about those things. And of course, you travel. It is a harum-scarum way to go down the road when you're in those buses, or any of the vehicles for that matter. And you just end up praying about things you don't think about praying just when you drive from your house down here to Ace Hardware. But I think that it's good for me to involve God more personally in my life. And so that's one of the benefits I receive from going to Bangladesh. Oh, there's many things to pray about. What is the purpose of even sharing a story like this, our travels? I think it's twofold. Number one, it goes back to what I read to you, and that is, I want to tell you what God did with us, because it is His work and it's His church. But number two, if there is some way that in some fashion we can at least connect our hearts to those people. I know one of the things that stretches my logic is that whole thing of, okay, we left Huntington Furnace Road and we began to travel. From the time I left Huntington Furnace Road till I threw my bags down in that little concrete house on a mat in the corner in Bajwa was, I had figured it out, I think it was around 50 hours, so a little better than 2 days. We were just on the move, going. And one of the things you think about is you look out the jet window, and you get, I remember we were coming into Doha, and I'm looking at the sands of Saudi Arabia, and you see a couple tents down there, and you realize that there's people at least one-tenth the distance, one-fourth the distance, half the distance around the world that I could have ministered to as well. And it's kind of bewildering to wonder how and why I should leave Huntington County and go into that village and start talking to people about Jesus and how to live the Christian life. But I know that I can't go everywhere, and for some reason God seems to have arranged that I would be laid upon my heart to go there. All I'm saying is that God is building a church, and I think we all need to be open to going where God wants to send us. And I know that He's not going to send you all there, and I know He's not going to send me everywhere. But He's going to all do something with us. And God bless you as you reach out to your neighbors, the people you meet on your work, but we have to go. One of the integral pieces of Christianity is that you and I open this mouth and say something. Reach out. God is He's not only depending on it, He has commanded it. We're supposed to have revivals in about a week and a half down at the Strasbourg congregation. I'm working on a sermon out of Isaiah. I have set watchmen upon the walls which shall never hold their peace. These are the words of God Himself in prophecy about the new kingdom that He's setting up. I have set watchmen upon the walls which shall never hold their peace. And it tells me that in this kingdom that we have, God is not only depending, He is intrigued and interested that He would have a lineup of followers that talk and minister to Him. And I'd just like to challenge each one of us whether you do that. Pray for the work. We lift offerings, give to the work, and you would be welcome to go along. I don't even know who to ask, but all you'd have to do is kind of cough and say, I'd like to see that sometime, and I can direct you where to get a visa. get your passport renewed. I can show you where to get the COVID tests, and I can give you some travel tips on what makes that airplane flight a little bearable. Take some Tums along, because those spices don't agree with Americans, but you can go along. And we'd be happy to it. One of the things we wrestle with as a board is we really wish we had more helpers, people that we could be sending in on these teams. We're never going to go and live in those villages and be the leaders of that work. We have no interest in it. We're pretty sure that's not even the right thing to do. But we plan to be like this Paul that I read to you about, that goes out and moves through the churches, and then he writes letters back and tells them how to correct. And he says, if you don't fix it, when I come, I'll fix it for you. It's just how he did church life, and it's what we're trying to do there. And any one of you is welcome to go along and help. And you'll be way out of your comfort zone. The rest of us are too, but you can. And I'd just like to invite you to do that as well. Let's kneel for prayer.